Good morning, everybody. I'm going to share development economics with you. Actually, I'm a bit of an interdisciplinary mutt, so forgive me if I tend to go three different directions, because that's exactly what I am. I am in the middle of my PhD as well. I share your pain. We were discussing that at some point maybe it'll get done. So this is actually in the middle of my process of writing my dissertation. Let me give you a little bit of context before I move on. First of all, I started out as an economics major. Then I moved to a psychology major, and then later moved on to comparative religions, and then found out that all three of them would be what I would work in. I know, it sounds an entirely bit of, like I said, I'm an interdisciplinary mutt. Shrinking cities have become quite an issue. But there's also been tons of urbanization. There's been this shift with populations. With the process of deindustrialization, what ended up happening is highly industrialized areas, you know, began to lose business, which eventually began to lose population. In fact, there's a lot of research done here in Germany, in the area for Europe, and a lot of the stuff that's based on in the U.S., they really took from Germany. It's kind of interesting. So here's the areas in which there is a lot of deindustrializations, the shrinking cities. That is currently the context in which I live right now. This is Youngstown, Ohio. This is closer to the east coast of the United States. I am not from Youngstown originally. I ended up there kind of on accident, truthfully. I felt like I was always trying to get away from it, and God kept putting me back there somehow. Till eventually, my husband and I began a church plant. And so Youngstown originally had 150,000 people within it. It was known to be one of the largest areas for steel. It's right between two other steel cities, Cleveland, Ohio, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And then there's an entire northeast section called the Rust Belt. And the deindustrialization just caused so many problems. So what began to happen at first is you began to lose some people here and there. But then when the steel mills closed down, and the last major one closed down in 1977 in Youngstown. And so when that one closed down, then there became this kind of mass migration where everybody moved out to the suburbs or began to drive to other cities or move to other local areas, whether it be Cleveland or Pittsburgh. But Cleveland and Pittsburgh for a while had the same problem. So they all had to find a way to begin to kind of give themselves a new identity. It began to ask that question, if we are not, you know, the steel tycoons, then what are we? Who are we? So if you look at the history of a lot of the where the steel mills were, which is kind of interesting, they divided all of the mills according to people groups. And so to this day, Youngstown is set up in multiple people groups. One area is mostly known as Greek, one area is mostly known as Italian, another one is completely Hungarian. You have, it's just entirely different. There's an Orthodox church per usually each type of background. And so when you look at the maps of how the steel mills were broken up, because a lot of people didn't want to learn each other's cultures or each other's languages, so if they just put them in this area, okay, if you're Hungarian, you're going to work in this section because that's where all the Hungarians work. If you're this, you work in that section. And when I first moved to the area, what I did not realize is the reason for all of these kind of ethnic pockets, because they'll tell you, well, the Greeks live in this area, and the Hungarians live here, and the Polish live here, and I was really confused until I began doing quite a bit of research. And I looked at this map on how they had organized the steel mills and what the steel mills had done. So now, one of the issues that we personally have faced is people are very, very hopeless, because we're talking, these are now second and third generation people that were left behind. You know, they've lost much of the original culture that came over with their family, but they still have aspects of it. Some of them still identify with that culture, but also identify very much as Americans. And there's kind of this tug of war with how do you do this? should we be working together? How do we work together? You know, how is hopelessness defined? And there's been a lot of questions in the role of hope and how it affects development economics. This is just a picture to show you. These were some of the mansions that were left behind. These are now boarded up. These are centers that once used to have some of the greatest wealth in our community now are either boarded up because of they become quite an issue for drugs and prostitution and other things, or they've sold them for a couple dollars for us, which would just be, actually just like a pound for you. And with that case, then they, with the agreement that whoever gets them goes ahead and signs a contract saying, you must put this much money into it for this amount of time, and you have this long to fix it up, and it must be usable again for the community. And so they began to do this, and apparently in 1977, when the last steel mill closed, they started this process, but then it failed late 80s to early 90s. So what they decided to do was develop an organizing collaborative. One focused more on the political side, while the other one focused more on the kind of like the grassroots side. This is the remains of some of the steel mills. These are not uncommon at all to see in the Rust Belt. Just big open spaces that, truthfully, you walk in, you can get hurt. This particular, I was doing a photo shoot with somebody, and just so happened I thought it would be good for research to take these pictures. But we have all of these. And so what happens is this. When my husband and I first moved in the community, and he's originally from there, but I am not. So I got this question of, you try to talk to people and they were just hopeless. Well, we've tried that before. That doesn't work. I'm like, well, you know, maybe your hope is found in Jesus. And they're like, no, that doesn't work either. So they tried a variety of methods. And truthfully, I was extremely frustrated when we first moved there. Just some of the things that we had to deal with. This is the church that my husband and I currently pastor. I teach at university. We pastor this church. It's on the inner city portion of Youngstown. And then in the meantime, I also work with the Youngstown Women Christian Association as well, doing community work based in relationships. So that's my husband, Gene. And when we took this picture, we had just originally started at the church. And we began to really research the community. We had lived there a while. We bought a home very close by. We figured there was absolutely no way that we could minister to these people without living like them. I was from an upper middle class family. He was raised extremely poor. We came from opposite ends of the spectrum. And truthfully, if you would have seen us somewhere, we were the least likely to succeed at anything. You know how you sometimes look like that person? We were that people. Sometimes still are, I suppose. That kind of messed up my PowerPoint a bit. But anyway, this is something that was recently released online that most cities have suffered. The ones with the migration problem has suffered a 60% drop in population since 1960. As you see, there are a wide variety of locations. Most of them are not in the U.S., but one in particular, there is one in California, and Youngstown, Ohio rates number 9 on a list of 12. And when we first got there, I'll be honest with you, I didn't think of it so much as a mission field. I just thought we were doing a church plant and it would be much easier than this. Turns out it wasn't. And it was very much a missions field. Oops. Okay, so development economics. I tend to walk around a lot. So if I tend to move and you can't hear me, let me know. It focuses on the process of development in impoverished or low-income areas. It looks at mostly the development, the structure, the growth, and the maintenance, which most of you know. That sounds lovely. Okay, great. There's the definition. Now we have to go put it into practice. How do you do that? And I'm going to argue that a majority of it is done through relationship and through hope. Because development economics has really become something kind of at the forefront of economics within probably the last 5 years in particular. This particular quote was taken from The Economist. The idea that an infusion of hope can make a big difference of the lives of wretchedly poor people sounds like something dreamed up by a well-meaning or a tub-thumping politician. as you can see, when you bring subjective terms in like hope, how do you define hope? What is hope? Is your hope different than my hope? Well, the interesting thing about hope is that in some ways it is a very broad and difficult to define term. But I would like to argue that development economics adds a really unique type of hope. It gives you a way to organize and begin to look at things economically and deal with a very physical portion, but nonetheless, it still leaves out a very spiritual aspect. There's something in us that always longs for something more. And one of the churches in our area tended to recognize that. They had never done any sort of community outreach prior to this particular outreach. They just decided that they had seen enough desperate people that they were going to try something. And so I'm driving along one of the main intersections in our neighborhood, and as I'm driving along, I see this, like, for miles. There are tons and tons of cars just backed up, and I see people running in and out of traffic. I'm not sure what is going on at this point. And as I go through, I realize that there are people in this white tent, and what they had set up was drive-through prayer. Now, this is an area that's considered one of the bleakest cities on earth. That we know that urbanization, it's estimated that by 2030 that like a majority of the population will live in cities. And that will be an urbanized location. And so what do you do when some of the urban centers are growing larger and other ones are growing smaller? How do you wrestle with the emotions, the physical portion of going from one location to the other, where some people have the advantage of moving out, where some people are lucky if they have water or if they have food? In fact, Youngstown has a huge issue with food, but they also have a lot of government welfare, which is kind of interesting. So the economists tended to kind of poke fun at the issue of, okay, we put hope in economics, what are we really doing here? We're just opening up a can of worms. And for any of you, has anybody read Poor Economics by Esther Duflo? Nobody's read it, okay. Esther Duflo had written Poor Economics. Have you read that? No, okay. Red Reviews. Okay. Her and one of her friends at MIT have gone all over the place, right? They've studied economics in a variety of forms, but her specialty is development economics. You know, she's well known in the field. It's not an uncommon name to hear. Her reviews all over the place. There are pros and cons to her book, I'll be honest with you, and I'm not going to go into critiquing her book currently. But one of the things that she tends to push on is this issue of hope. With all the development economics that they've done over the last 5 years in particular, a majority of it has been in like the Europe, Asia, especially India. They spent a lot of time in India. One of the things that they noticed was that there was a hope factor that they never counted on, that there was something entirely different that they had never quite come across. And so Esther Duflo says this: if you feel the future is bleak, then it will be bleaker than it would have otherwise have been. Hopelessness is incapacitating. What they noticed, that it didn't matter where they did the study, whether it was the U.S., whether it was Asia, whether it was Europe, that everywhere that they had done these studies, that the big issue was, how do you deal with the psychological factor of hope? How do you get someone to believe that you can get from point A to point B? In a local research thing that I had done a few years ago, I was just kind of curious. One of our biggest private funded nonprofits in our area is actually a city mission. They are completely privately funded so that they can do Bible studies or whatever it is that they would prefer to do. And while doing that, I went down there and asked if I could do a little bit of research on asking, so if I were to give you this scale and I want you to plan a trip to Paris. Okay, right now, from living in the city mission, if I wanted you to plan a trip for Paris because that is your big dream, tell me the steps that it would take to get from here to Paris. Well, it's really easy for me, right? I can get online, I can go on the internet, I can put in, you know, what plane I want to ride on, what hotels I want to stay at, and book everything. About 85% of the people that I talked to absolutely could not even wrap their minds around the fact that they could even take a trip to Paris in the first place. Because they were lost in the, I don't even know if I have the hope to get from point A to point B. And they could get maybe to the first step. Well, I would probably want a job. I would probably want to do this. I would probably want to do that. But once they got to the first, maybe the second step, very few of them could get themselves just to a trip to Paris. Hope has been talked about a lot in positive psychology. This is where I'm the interdisciplinary mutt. In this particular case, positive psychology has looked at the concept of hope before with C.R. Snyder. And when he looked at it, he measured it as willpower and way power. And not too long ago, a couple years ago, there was a study done with people that had chronically ill children. And in this particular study, they called it pathways and agents, but it ultimately came back to willpower and way power. And when they were looking at the chronically ill families, they found that there were some families that were far more hopeful than others. And then the study broke down exactly. Some of them had, whether it was a good support, a good faith background, there was a variety of reasons, but most of them had some sort of very healthy support system. And many of them reverted back to their family or some form of faith, which all are based in relationships. And this was in a psychological and scientific study. So when you went ahead and looked at it, let me also explain this with a context. I've worked a lot with chronically ill families over the years. And I've spoke a lot at one of the medical schools in Cleveland, Ohio. It's called Case Western Reserve. With pediatric hematologists, right? So people with blood issues mostly. And they brought me in a lot of times because of the hope factor, because they had worked with a variety of families over the years, but they had worked with my family for specific reasons. And while working with my family, they're like, there's something about your family that no other family has. And I was asked to come in and speak to a variety of these medical students. I mean, people training to be doctors someday. Why? Because they saw an aspect of hope that they hadn't seen anywhere else. So here's the flaw according to the positive psychology portion, is that they're worried about there's a situational component. The days they worry about the emotional roller coaster, how there are the mountaintop experiences as well as those moments of valleys. And we know that we all get them. Even Jesus in the Bible, you know, you could tell that some days were harder for him than others. He did sweat blood, after all. I mean, that had to have been a rough moment. So the call to servanthood, to hold to a doctrine or an opinion with the intellect alone, is to believe it. And a man's real belief is that which he lives by. I'd like to argue that the church is the primary agent into releasing hope, that it becomes the power broker within the community. The problem is the fine line between dependency, how do you do that, what does it look like? All relationships can be different because my relationship with my family is different than my professional relationships. What are the parameters that you live by? So the question ends up being this, and I think this is the question that most people ask. We feel the call, we raise the money, we go, then what? You get on the ground and you spend a majority of your time learning what to do, what not to do, etc. But truthfully, what you're really doing is researching and building relationships. That is all you're doing. And I would have to agree with John this morning as far as the component of gifts and then food. I have some good friends that they went to Israel for a while, and one of the Americans asked a very personal question. And the couple looked at them and said, absolutely not, I won't answer that until we've had a meal together. So building relationship doesn't look the same in every culture, and especially when a lot of that is a learned process. I'm going to challenge your perspective a bit. That's what I'm really good at, is challenging perspectives. The discussion in John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11, when Jesus is confronted with the prostitute. You're wondering how that's going to work into development economics. When the Pharisees bring the prostitute in front of Jesus and they start the process of you should judge her, right? Jesus doesn't really say much. And I want you to think about something. This woman knew the laws of the land. She would have known what to do and what not to do. And even though she had spent years of people judging her, okay, she didn't change. She was still caught in prostitution. However, one encounter with God, one encounter with Jesus, and he shows grace and instantly hope. Instantly, that encounter of grace changes something. It wasn't a long encounter, right? It was just a few simple sentences, and God changed her life forever. And I want to say that that's the role of the church. That usually when we encounter people, especially an unreached people group, realize that you are their first example of what Jesus did. They will not understand God until they look at your life normally. And it's the same thing when you raise children, usually. I've worked with a lot of child psychologists and counselors in a variety of settings. And interestingly enough, every one of them usually tells me, if you really want your children to understand Jesus, then you need to make sure that you model him at home because you are your child's first understanding of who God is. That should put us to a higher standard, but also make us realize that that also makes us power brokers. But you have to do that in a way that is relational so that there isn't the dependency. Shifting our cultural perspective, I'm not going to read you the whole quote, but Dallas Willard tends to, one of the things that he said about Western culture is pretty much we mess it up. We don't tend to handle things very well. That we tend to go more on rejection, that we tend to focus more on judgment and make people feel rejected in certain contexts instead of making them feel like they're accepted no matter what. When we look at John 8, we don't see Jesus look at the prostitute and look at her and just say, you know, I've rejected you, because the law had spent enough time rejecting her. However, when she encounters grace, instantly, she's changed. And so I want to challenge you that when it comes to relationships, that you don't work out of rejection, that you work more upon relationships. And if anybody wants a copy of this, I can send you a PowerPoint. Four foundational relationships. This is, Corbett and Fickert has become, you know, pretty well known overall. But one of the things that I really like about Corbett and Fickert is the relationship. That there are four foundational relationships with God, with self, with others, and the rest of creation. And we have to realize that if we're working on relationship, that these should be the four that we're really focusing on. Because while we're going through the process of economic development, it's pretty hard to get from point A to point B unless you realize the relationships that you're going to be in. So if you don't have the constant relationship with God, if you don't take your devotional time, if you don't go ahead and realize how you're affecting others, as well as your responsibility to God's creations and how important that is. Okay, so I need one volunteer. Just for a second, I promise I won't make you do anything horrible. No dramatizations. Okay, thank you. All right, we're gonna make this nice and simple.
I'm much better looking than that.
Okay, all right, well, here.
There you go.
All right. Now, this is our gap that we have to kind of work through cross-culturally. Okay, so our big issue is going to be communication. So, build me a bridge of communication.
A bridge of communication.
A bridge of communication, uh-huh. Just simplest form, you're working with stick figures. Okay. Very nice. Okay, so what does he draw in here? A foundation. What is the foundation of any relationship? You ever thought about it? We're building relationships and we're not sure what they're based on. I'm sorry, go ahead. Trust? What's the other one? Hope comes afterwards. Common interest, but there's something that all comes after these two things. Okay, the other one is respect. What we're doing most of the time when we are building relationships, we are building a bridge of communication, but you cannot do that unless you have trust and respect at the foundation. And so most of the time we start talking about big theories, but we forget what all of it's built on. Every relationship that Jesus established in Scripture, did you not notice that instantly they're based on the issue of trust and respect? He knew the culture which he was in. He knew how to go ahead and define it. He became one of it, and yet he was still not of it. See, we tend to forget the fact that Jesus wasn't completely of the culture, even though he was. He was an insider and an outsider all at the same time. A lot of times when people begin to talk about the communication bridge, what they tend to do is they forget the foundation and they build something that looks like a ladder, and this is gone. More often than not, that is one of the biggest flaws that we tend to make when we're in a cross-cultural setting, even within actual relationships that we deal with. So this is connecting, of course, the sender and the receiver. This was actually taken from a counseling book. I'm going to discuss some of them very briefly. Some of this is just too much to go into at this point. Relationships must include structured priorities. You have to understand what the relationship is built upon, why you're doing what you're doing. There needs to be clarity of that. Grace and truth. We see with Jesus, when he's talking to the prostitute, that he's very much speaking truth, and he does challenge the culture. He challenges her living. He challenges the Pharisees, all the watchers, but yet he does it with such incredible grace. Then we have this healthy dependency. Now, here's the healthy dependency, okay? Dependency is kind of a tricky word. Our healthy dependency is on the Lord. So you need to remember that no matter what you're doing in your relationships, that the healthy dependency that you must have must be upon the Lord when you're building those relationships. The positive or affirming communication, this is very much what Jean talked to us about. The aspect of communication that when you are speaking to people, sometimes it's our habit to critique before we build up. And I want to challenge you that you don't go ahead and start with your critiquing, but you go in there wide-eyed, almost childlike, for that moment that you can sit there and say, well, that part is quite lovely. That works. And that's when you begin the asset-based community development. You go in there with proper authority. You need to realize that even though you're going to maybe help out or encourage or walk alongside, that you still have responsibility for the roles that you're in. Don't ever forget that that is a foundation of relationship. Responsibility and accountability. Who do you answer to? Well, first of all, God. Of course, you have missions agencies and things like that, but also realize that it's really good to have people that you're accountable to that keep you in line. Then, whatever you have, you should be able to transfer. It should be something that you passed on. We see this with Elijah to Elisha, right? Instantly, he passes on his mantle. And there are multiple examples in Scripture in which things were transferred from generation to generation, in which mantles were handed off or anointings or whatever it is that you would prefer to call them. And so whatever you should do, you should be able to take your hands off at any point. Because remember, if God holds you like this, how can you handle your work for him like this? Oh. The possible setback is the being the outsider coming in. Always remember that there's this process that you have to go through, and a lot of it is just being wide-eyed. The church is a power broker. Jesus says this in Luke 4, and of course it's also read when he's reading Isaiah 61, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoner, recovery of the sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." We already know that's what he came for, right? It's said that multiple times in Scripture, but have you ever really thought about the weight of what that's saying? That there are assets that we have been given, and God's saying, you know, there are some things that we're bound in, and there's other things that we're free in. Okay, poverty. Real quick, we're going to fly through this and then get to the question of answer section. Poverty is a result of relationships that do not work. They are not just. They are not for life. They are not harmonious or enjoyable. Poverty is the absence of shalom in all of its meaning. Corbett and Fickert took the spiritual side and applied it to some of the development side. Excuse me. Okay. Mm-hmm. Poor economics and the end of poverty, those are both some of the like common reads for economics, especially in the United States. Jeffrey Sachs, for the end of poverty, made like the New York Times bestseller list, and there were so many flaws with some of his theories. So think of poverty alleviation. Poverty is not necessarily poverty in the way that we think of money or economics all the time. It is a portion of it, but the church is also offering the spiritual aspect of it. I don't have time to go through all of it with you, but I'd like to share this case study with you, and then we'll get to questions. In Cleveland, Ohio, it was one of the deindustrialized areas, and one of the groups of churches got together, and they decided that they were going to conquer homelessness. Now, that's a big undertaking. Most people just, you know, that'll just never be overcome and a variety of things, and we tend to give up on some of those things and stick to what we're doing. So they decided that they were going to go ahead and change their perspective. A lot of times homelessness, especially in Western culture, tends to focus on this "are you worthy of it" factor. This group decided that they were going to change that, that they weren't going to go ahead and look at the "are you worthy," but that they were going to look at them as they themselves, as a human being, created in the image of God, were an asset in and of themselves, and created what they called supportive housing. And within supportive housing, they were able to, now this is out of the norm, in this particular case, they began to bring people in that already, I mean, they have drug and alcohol, they've had backgrounds of prostitution, and they have ways to sort through all of that. I can't go through the extremes of it right now because there's a lot of it. And they went ahead and applied this, and their homelessness has dropped by 65% in Cleveland, Ohio, focused on asset-based community development, in which they began to apply the spiritual with the physical. Only 2% of those people who have gone into the supportive housing have gone back to being either homeless or living in one of the city missions. All the others have completely stayed. And most of them end up in some sort of social service work or ministry-based work. And it's been highly successful. There's a ton I could share with you, but I would like to challenge you to understand that we have a unique approach when we're working as either missionaries or a pastor or a church in general, is that we value humans in a different way. And I'm going to challenge your perspective to be more like Jesus. That instead of looking at the prostitute and saying, "Are you worthy?" you sit there and say, "Okay, what are your assets?" And then out of grace and love, challenge what's in front of you. Any questions? Yes.
Can I appreciate that presentation, bringing up your different authors, even Sachs appeared, and hope as a commodity. Mm-hmm. Speaks loudly to saying the relevance for mission to the modern world. Perhaps, right. You know, I didn't see that. I'm just wondering, what I heard from you is that encouragement of what someone's doing, the wide-eyed approach. What if the system is corrupt? Can you should be wide-eyed, fantastic. You're doing a great job, and the system is corrupt.
Okay, no, I understand what you're saying. Because usually we lose a portion of our innocence as we grow up because of the fact that things discourage us. But I would like to challenge you that that is why Jesus went ahead and he took so much time alone, is that there were crowds that were always waiting for Jesus, that his source was always his Heavenly Father. And so Jesus was able to minister intensely for 3 years. I mean intensely. But I also think that there's wisdom in boundaries. When you're looking at relationships, you can't be running all the time. So yes, you need to have wisdom, but there's something about the faith-based portion that gives us an element of hope that keeps us believing when nobody else does. You know, why do you do what you do? Why do you care to be here this morning? Maybe some of you came off the field discouraged. Some of us are looking for answers. But there's still that portion in us that goes so much deeper, that's saying, you know, I want that. And even if it's just a little glimmer of hope, it's also our biggest asset when we're going ahead and we're doing anything. And I want to say that's how Jesus was so successful, is that he knew what he was rooted in. Okay, think about Daniel and Esther in particular. Daniel was completely taken out during, you know, a period into a culture that was not his own, and only pretty much with the elite young men of his time, while many other people were left behind. And nonetheless, Daniel spent 3 years before he ended up in front of King Nebuchadnezzar. You realize that, right? 3 years learning the culture. He won the favor of some of the palace first, and then he was put out there. And if Daniel, and even Esther, the same thing, she very much should not have succeeded within the realm that she was in. But what do? They became overwhelmed at time. They realized that they were in a corrupt society. So what's the first thing they did? They called a fast. They worshiped the Lord. They quieted themselves before him. And then all else came into play when they needed it. And I want to argue that that is your biggest asset during your development, as well as your relational building.
I have to stand up. first of all, well, thank you very much. Very interesting. And first of all, just a comment. I do think the concept of a theological understanding of hope underpins a lot of this, and is very, very important. And just to mention another text, I think Bishop Tom Wright, sometimes writes as N.T. Wright, his book on, I forgot his title, someone help me, it's just called Hope, or Christian Hope, or Surprised by Hope, of course it is, yeah. Is a very important theological text for what you've been talking about. My other, more of a question, comes, actually my father was a civil engineer and he built bridges all his life, some of them just down the road in Suffolk. I love your picture, but not all bridges are as simple as that. and I think that the challenge, I think, for many of us is that either the one side of the bridge is higher than the other side. And that may be because community structures are much stronger in one context, or it may be that economic structures are much stronger in one context. And so you have bridges that are sloping, and therefore the way in which you build trust and respect as your foundations or your supports underneath is actually quite different. And I think that's one of the big challenges for us as we try and build these bridges. And the other thing that comes into that picture is actually you have a river flowing underneath, which is actually often nothing to do with the partners with either bank, but it is that the external contextual pressures that are on any relationship, and that context can actually wash away the bridge. And so, when you're building the trust and respect, you actually need to have a view on the river coming underneath and how you protect yourself or protect the relationship against the flow of the river. So, sorry, that all comes out of civil engineering, but
my husband and I worked in El Salvador for a while, and I've spent a decent amount of time in the UK off and on. But in El Salvador, it was an entirely different context, and you're completely right. It was the cultural and the power issues were very different. When doing research there, you know, it was one thing for me to go in, but when I began doing research, when I was asking questions, I could tell at first that I was not getting honest answers because it was the slope bridge, right? I came in this particular way, and then it took me some time to build the relationships. And you're right, the water portion of it is entirely different. But I also want to say that sometimes we look at situations that just are seemingly impossible. Once again, I'm going to go back to Daniel and Esther. They really should have never, ever succeeded within the context that they were in at all. And yet, miraculously, God gave them plans each and every time. In fact, when you look at Daniel, he was under numerous empires. And while he's going through those few, he always somehow wins favor because he had God's favor and he was smart enough to quiet himself throughout the entire theory. So I can't answer all of your questions, of course. And there's more that I just don't have time to unpack. But I do want you to know that it's very possible, because if God did it for others, he'll do it for us. I mean, because we know that he promises those things, that he's good. All right, any other thoughts or questions?
You've got cities which you've got the steel industry disappearing and people are moving out. There's a situation that I'd like to explore, and that is about generational poverty, because obviously this is just something that's arrived or over the last few years. But where I live in Andover, we have a situation where we have housing estates, or you might call them projects or social housing, where people have been taken from London, for example, and they have been planted out in the countryside. And these people actually have quite severe physical and mental problems because they've been cut off from their communities. And in fact, the local health authorities recognise those areas as being large areas of deprivation. Now, I'm particularly interested in, because I've been living up on a social development since 86, how you actually break through this whole area of generational poverty.
This has been kind of complicated. We've found that working within the community, we've worked with a couple different organizing collaboratives, and they've developed what they call Ohio Prophetic Voices in our area. It is a link of churches with all different backgrounds. And what they began to do is, you know, there's such a separation of church and state in our area. And so when they found a way to dialogue together with the same goal, and they've actually made the community and the clergy, they've done a lot of grassroots organizing, and they've used the community and the clergy, the people that are kind of already in the trenches, if you would, and they've put them at the table, and they've really created a very interesting structure. It's not ideal, and there are definitely some problems with their model, because they've made their own hybrid of models so on an economic development thing. But ultimately, they've done a pretty decent job with bringing in, let me give you an example. The one lady has three or four generations of poverty in her family, where they lived on the welfare system, that everything that they tried to do, pretty much they purposely put themselves back on the welfare system, because why work when I'm getting free money and free healthcare? You know, it was that type of thing in our particular context. And you would try to do food giveaways, but people wouldn't do food giveaways, but they would go to the welfare office and they would try to get, you know, some sort of food stamps or something. And the biggest thing was giving them a voice in a very unique way. So what they began doing is they first organized by the community. And they just created an open forum. And they found out what each community was good at, what their strengths and their weaknesses were. And as they went to go ahead and look at the strengths and weaknesses of each community, right, then they went ahead and began to let them share together. Because you find out that when many of them were in a room, they had common problems. and some of them were displaced. So there were just a lot of issues. And one of the issues in our area in particular is we have a huge problem with heroin, and we have a lot of mental illness. And so dealing with that and then creating, like you said, psychological issues on top of that, because some of these people have, you know, children, or there's generational issues, and that part has been the hardest of it. And so some churches have specialized in taking the really difficult cases. I hate to say it this way, that nobody else wants to take. In fact, that's what my husband and I do. We see ourselves as like the emergency room of the people that nobody else wants to deal with. And a lot of that, you see them fail constantly. There's one thing I'd like to point out with relationships. Every relationship that we allow, what we're really saying is we're not only allowing for success, but we're allowing for failure, because that's what God does with us, that he is not only allowing for success, but he also allows for failure, and he gives us such grace in that. So one of the things that I really encourage you to think about is, depending, you know, I'm not as familiar with your context, but finding the people that have a similar passion and that are willing to give people the space to succeed and fail without judgment. And then bringing that affirmation forward. It was just little things like that, and building relationship and affirming. I can't tell you how many times we had one gentleman that came in on drugs and alcohol into a church service, and he said the same thing every time. And we've had mentally ill people like stumble in the middle of service. That doesn't make any difference in our world at all. It doesn't disrupt anything for us. So I think part of it is just giving people the space to have a voice and to succeed or fail. And you can only really deal with the psychological issues once you're willing to kind of walk alongside of them. And at times they'll break your heart, and you just have to be ready for that. Does that help at all? You're welcome.
This may be implicit in everything you've said, but there seems to be a word missing on that for me, and that's the word love. We worked with prostitutes in Ethiopia. Ethiopia had the highest percentage of prostitutes per head of population of any country in the world. And prostitution there is poverty-driven, not drug or alcohol-driven. And the thing the girls said over and over again was, you demonstrated love. And that did something. We didn't know where it came from. They did discover where it came from eventually. But that gave them a sense of self-worth and being important and worthy. And I just wonder, I think it probably is implicit in everything you've said, but that seems to be the foundation for me.
Yes, I don't technically have love in here. Actually, this is kind of funny. This is actually from a parenting class, the relational portion of it. We've taught, my husband and I have taught a lot of parenting class, and of course, we premise it with, you know, if you're sharing God's love with your children, but that you still need to base it on trust and respect. Because one of the things that we fail in with our understanding of love is that it is not at all an emotion. It's just not. It's not something that you feel. It's something that you choose to do every day even when you don't want to. And when you're building relationships and when you're doing missions and when you're doing the asset-based community development, you have to realize that you're in there for a reason and that your foundation very much should be love. But I would hope that if you love the Lord, that would be what you'd be working from anyway, is love, and that it would very much be a choice. So yes, it's, you know, intertwined throughout the entire thing, but not specifically said at this point.
Just on the application, isn't there an area of typology to be explored? You started with, at least you included, an example of deindustrialization. There are large areas, of course, in the world which are pre-industrialization. There are also industrialized countries, developed countries. I'm just surprised that we're going to be offered the same analysis in those totally different situations. So development economics, of course, does maybe over emphasizes the politics of development and misses out on opportunities to reduce the stress and strain of daily living.
You're right. And first of all, I started out with the deindustrialized approach, but you're right, there's very much development. And development economics I find to be very complicated, to be honest with you, for a variety of reasons. Because when we talk about application, what we're really saying is we want everything we come here for, we want to apply it to our context. So I simply started out with my context, which was a deindustrialized area. Now, I've worked in a wide variety of contexts, but this is the particular context in which I'm in right now. In some ways, yes, I agree, it is the same analysis. But to another degree, I'd like to argue that it's not. Because one thing that development economics fails in terribly, even if you're doing a census of an area, is that we tend to look at numbers and statistics, and we tend to look at poverty or things along those lines in a very narrow approach. And it's only been within the last, what, 5 or 10 years in which development economics realizes that there's a whole lot more to our understanding of what poverty is than just numbers or money or political systems. Because development economics looked at a lot of structures. You know, what is this structure? How is this? And then they applied different things in a variety of forms. But I think what development economics is missing is the fact that there's a psychological aspect that no one's really thought about before. And to be honest with you, like in our area, MIT and some of the people at Harvard are just beginning to look into this. This is very much a developing field on development economics. It's complicated because development economics is not something that has been a favored type of economics in the first place. And then on top of that, now that there are some kind of big hitters looking at it, they're like, well, there's this, and it's good, and it's bad. But now that the psychological factor is coming into play, it opens up another topic that nobody really expected. How do you deal with the thinking process? And I would argue that a lot of that is taken care of with, like, the church and a faith-based approach. And much of what you'll do is going to be based, it'll just be those God-given moments where Daniel like laid out things before the Lord and said, I just need you to show me what to do. And I'd like to argue that that is what development economics is missing. And so when you're going through it, I have more of the structure and thing later on the PowerPoint, and I'd have to, it was a bit longer than I thought. So my apologies. But when I can send out the paper at some point, but I do look at the structures more and offer some more in-depth looks with some examples from development economics. Any other questions?
Final question.
Okay.
It's not really a question, but I can relate to the idea of sort of cycles of poverty and being trapped in poverty and, you know, destructive behaviours. And I'm not coming from a development economics, it doesn't mean a lot to me, but just in terms of life-to-life sharing relationships, do you see that Christian hope or being able to offer people Christian community, can that break these cycles? Is that something that you can expand on at all?
You know, I think it can break the cycles. Working in El Salvador, I saw how there were some cycles that had been broken I actually spent some time working in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles is interesting because every other neighborhood is something different. One minute you're serving to Koreans, the next minute you're serving to, you know, El Salvadorians, the next minute you're serving to Mexicans, and then, you know, you're somewhere in between. And within, you know, just a few blocks, you've gone from extreme poverty to extreme wealth, and found it very complicated at first. But what I found really interesting about some of the dream centers and things is that they have so many variety of programs. But here's where their success lies. First of all, they tend to stay with the original vision, first of all. But the other thing is usually there's a person that comes to them and says, I've got a passion for this because either I've been in it or I have a heart for it somehow. And they don't at all enable them. They literally stand up and say, okay, we'll walk alongside of you. You get it running and we'll support you. And when you begin doing that, you find those people that have the heart for that specific thing. You'd have to find someone that has a heart for breaking the cycle, the cyclic poverty, to just run with it. And I think taking on the whole thing of cyclical poverty at once is a bit too much, because it's like taking on the world. You know, when my daughter was little, she used to sit there and say, I pray for the whole world. I'm like, well, that's lovely faith. It's great and vast. And I'm like, would you like to pray specifically for some family members or some friends? And she couldn't think that way yet. And I think that sometimes when we look at poverty and we look at economic developments, we tend to think so broadly, but it's really kind of one relationship and one thing at a time. So breaking that, I believe that the church offers a really unique way of doing that, because we can offer hope. And we can also, you know, work within a community, and we can walk alongside of people without enabling them and creating dependency. So as much as I want to say yes, you can very much break it that way. I think that it kind of takes like one relationship and one person at a time, and often we want really big right now responses and answers to everything. And much of what we see, yes, we speak to the masses and people change. But I worked with Billy Graham for a while in the United States, and one of the things that I thought was really, really amazing is that when 500 people would rush the altar and get saved at one of his, you know, big meetings somewhere, that the rest of the night, that his staff would stay up all night long, and they would put them into local churches and have them contacted within 24 hours with this huge network of churches, and then get them straight into discipleship within a local church. And it was one of the things that made Billy Graham's process really, really great as an evangelist in some areas, and a good majority of them stayed. In fact, I know one gentleman that he grew up in India, and I told him, I met him in Phoenix, Arizona, and when I met him, he looked at me and said, you know, I mentioned something, and he's like, I heard you worked with Billy Graham, and I'm like, I did for a bit, and he remembers when he was a child in India, and Billy Graham had come, and how it impacted his family. Billy Graham was in and out in a couple days, but they were plugged into a local church, and their entire life was changed, because after Billy Graham came as the evangelist, his staff stayed up, put them into a local church. The local church spent all that time building relationship and discipling, changed the entire family. Now they're a family of missionaries and pastors. We want it to be instantaneous, and sometimes it is, but more often it's just one thing at a time.
Thank you very much indeed, Christy. I think we can give her some applause. Feel free, of course, to collar Christy later on and ask her more questions and so forth. So welcome to Derek Belshaw, welcome to Mark Oxbrow. We're now going into group sessions. So many of you already know where you're going. Group A meets here. Mark, you're welcome to join this group. Group B at the back. Derek Belshaw, if you'd like to join Group E, which is in Room 2, which is just across there. Anyone not know where they're going? Hannah, do you want to go with Christy, I guess? Great. Anyone not know where they're going? Okay, same locations as yesterday, and then 1 o'clock is lunch, so I don't suppose you'll forget that. Thank you very much.
What we're doing in the groups, I think it's labelled as discussion.
discussion of the things that we've been coming up against.